From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm Patricia Bradford. Dialogue is an exchange about culture straight from the soul. Every day, hundreds of millions of people around the world are on their period. The World Bank estimates 500 million of them lack access to period products. But period poverty isn't just about pads and tampons. It's about lack of understanding, stigma, and the barrier it creates to education. In some classrooms, menstruation is the reason some never return. For IPM News, Noor Longhi takes us inside a school in Sierra Leone, where one group is trying to change that.
It's a hot day at Education for All, a school in Allentown. 13-year-old Khadija Mara starts her day off with chemistry. There are only 6 students in the class. Khadija sits in the front row, hunched over her desk, trying to focus as the heat thickens around her. The classroom, a patchwork of wooden poles and corrugated metal, offers little relief. There was a time Khadija thought she'd never sit in a classroom again.
When I started to see my period, I was 9 years old and I was in class 4. I feel a warm something.
She was on her way back home from school when she noticed she'd bled through her clothes.
The neighbors that were outside, everybody was shouting that I've stained my uniform. And there was a woman that said, "You are no more a child, you're an adult."
She says they laughed at her. And after that, she was too ashamed to go to school.
When I want to wear my uniform, the same woman that said that I'm no longer a baby, that I'm a adult, they mocked me and I went inside and took off my uniform. I was not coming to school.
Khadija was eventually able to return to school. But for many girls in Sierra Leone, the story ends differently. Dr. Yambo Fasalugu is a district medical officer with Sierra Leone's Ministry of Health. She says in low and middle income countries, lack of access to period products and social stigma can cause girls to miss out on school or even drop out.
About 20% of women and girls have dropped out of school due to period poverty.
Period products are expensive. The average household in Sierra Leone earns less than $50 a month. Fasaluku says period products there can cost $4 to $5 American a month. This is more than most families can afford, especially in households with multiple women.
Menstrual products is not going to be a priority because you want to eat, you want to make sure that you're healthy.
But Fasaluku says there are solutions. Small local organizations working directly with communities to break the stigma and provide pads. One of these groups is Umentok. The name means Woman Talk in Creole. Umentok sends people across the country to provide menstrual hygiene kits and reproductive health education to children. Mariatu Marlietta is Umentok's education director. She's at Education for All, the same school Khadija attends. Sun spills into the classroom as Yetta teaches a room full of 11 to 13-year-old girls about ovulation, menstrual cycles, and how to use a reusable pad.
They feel the release. How many days the egg they don't have the fallopian tube? 24 hours.
Dr. Fasaluku says groups like Umentok are making real progress. But that progress is fragile. In recent history, civil war, an Ebola epidemic, and the COVID-19 pandemic have slowed momentum. She says that lasting change will take national support through funding, education, and legislation that makes menstrual health a public priority. But while Umentok can't single-handedly solve period poverty in Sierra Leone, for girls like Khadija, these resources can change their lives. Khadija recently scored high on her secondary exams. She says her success stems from learning about her period.
It was horrible back then, but now it's really good. I'm reaching to my goals, but back then, I was having a stress on my period that was not focused. But now I'm focused.
She says she doesn't feel the same shame anymore either. Khadija dreams of being a nurse one day.
To help girls like me, to advise them and to teach them how to use the menstrual pads, and for them not to be ashamed but to be proud when they're seeing their periods.
Fulfilling this dream could be a challenge. Cathedra will graduate soon from Education for All, and she's not sure if her family can pay for the next steps. I'm Nurlangi, IPM News.
This story is part of the inaugural project of the Illinois Partnership for African Women's Health Narratives, involving journalism students from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Fora Bay College in Freetown, Sierra Leone. Earlier this month, President Trump signed an executive order to ban foreign nationals from 12 countries from entering the U.S., claiming the restrictions are for national security purposes. The list mirrors the travel ban he enacted in his first term, but it also includes a handful of new countries, including the Republic of Congo. The ban is hitting close to home in Champaign-Urbana, where more than 6,000 Congolese people live. The vast majority comes from a separate neighboring country, the Democratic Republic of Congo. IPM's May Antar spoke with Arjun Takar about how this community is feeling in this moment.
All right, May, could you first start off by explaining why thousands of Congolese people have resettled in Champaign-Urbana and what prompted them to leave their country?
Well, in short, the community wants peace. There are multiple wars going on in the Democratic Republic of Congo, also known as the DRC. It's a country in West Africa that's a third of the size of the U.S., and French, Lingala, and Swahili are widely spoken there. These conflicts are occurring between various ethnic groups over materials that are used in the U.S. and much of the developed world.
What materials are we talking about?
Yeah, the DRC is home to some of the world's largest reserves of cobalt, copper, zinc, and other rare earth minerals used to produce advanced electronics like our laptops, smartphones, and televisions. China owns most of the mines for these minerals and is paying some ethnic groups in the DRC to promote their interests and fight other ethnic groups in the area. I spoke with John Matanda. He's the president of the Champaign County Congolese Community Organization and a French teacher at Yankee Ridge Elementary School. He says the violence makes life perilous in the DRC.
Kids are killed every day. They are raping women. I have video that I can show you. So they are killing young people every single day. Since that war started, more than 6 million people have been killed.
Matanda also told me that he has grave concerns because the United States closed the embassy in the DRC earlier this year following protests.
The embassy was closed for more than 4 months, 4 months or so, and that was the first fear. Family was trying to do the petitions and everything was blocked. Family was trying to travel to visit family and it was impossible. So they supposed to pay for another plane to go to the country that our neighbor and find the U.S. Embassy in order for them to get interview. That was our first, it was scary.
So with President Trump's travel ban, are people from the Democratic Republic of Congo banned from coming to the United States right now?
No, not at this time. The administration's ban impacts the DRC's neighboring country, the Republic of Congo, as well as a few other countries, Chad, Haiti, Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Yemen, and others.
Members of the local Congolese community are here legally, but how have they been reacting to President Trump's crackdown on immigration and mass deportation campaign?
Yeah, well, Matanda says some people have stayed home from work and avoided going out in public to other activities.
Some people were scared to go even to the party because they said that the YMCA, no, this year, the Cunningham Township, they did 3 times the event year where people should go there and just get the ID, registration, car registration for free. And helping people, those just came, they have the detention documents, they have all those papers, but they don't if the idea. So they, we did it here at Media Center by the post office behind the courthouse. Three times. So people were scared even to attend that event because they say it was a trap. They could go there and then get arrested.
The president says he wants to prevent foreigners who will create problems and harbor hostile attitudes towards the U.S. from entering the country. What does Mutanda think about that?
Well, I asked him what he would say to President Trump if he had the chance, and here's what he told me.
The United States of America is a blessed country because it was built by immigrants. That's why they call it the land of opportunity. I will ask the decision, if there is any decision maker, please, please, American is great because immigrants are in America. So let America be great. Let America be great again, as the president say.
That was IPM's Arjun Takkar and May Antar discussing how Champaign-Urbana's Congolese community is reacting to President Trump's travel ban and immigration enforcement.
This is America. Don't catch you slipping now. Don't catch you slipping now. Look what I'm whipping now. This is America. Don't catch you slipping now. Don't catch you slipping now. Look what I'm whipping now. This is America. Don't catch you slipping now. Look how I'm living now. Police be tripping now. Yeah, this is America. Guns in my area. I got the strap. I gotta carry 'em. Yeah, yeah, I'ma go into this. Yeah, yeah, this is gorilla. Yeah, yeah, I'ma go get the bag. Yeah, yeah, or I'ma get the pad. Yeah, yeah, I'm so cold like, yeah. Yeah, I'm so dull like, yeah. We gon' blow like, yeah.
First published in 2015, Between the World and Me marked a turning point in how conversations about race were being held in mainstream media and literature. NPR's Michelle Martin revisits the book's release and the response it sparked across the country.
10 years ago, Ta-Nehisi Coates published the book Between the World and Me. The memoir, written as a letter to his then 15-year-old son, was a literary phenomenon. 10 years later, as Ta-Nehisi points out in his latest book, The Message, nearly half the country's school children are under state orders to be protected from, quote, critical race theory and other, quote, unquote, divisive concepts. Between the World and Me is now out in paperback on the 10th anniversary of its publication, so we thought this would be a good time to check back in with Ta-Nehisi Coates, and he's with us now. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Michelle. It's good to talk to you again.
You know, we actually spoke 10 years ago about this book. And
did we really?
Yes, we did.
Oh my God. Wow.
We actually have the tape of my talking to you 10 years ago. I think we'll drop it in.
Oh, please play a little bit of it. Oh God, that'll be great.
Sure. Let's hear it. Why not? Okay.
Yeah.
Do you feel that there is now some pressure to be kind of an oracle of race in a way that you did not feel before? Do you want that job?
No. And I've been, you know, very, very careful to tell people what I'm qualified to talk about and what I'm not qualified to talk about. And no one person should be, you know, the spokesperson, you know, for that experience. Well, no one person should be the oracle, be the articulator.
Yeah, I still agree with that. I haven't changed on that.
All right.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
And so I know that this is kind of a crazy, unknowable question. Is this what you hoped would happen as a result of this book?
Well, that's a great question. And it's a great question because I'm conflicted. Yes, to some extent. I wanted to be well-read like any writer wants to be well-read. I wanted to be well-respected as a writer like any writer wants to be well-respected. I remain somewhat flummoxed at the notion of writers as a kind of oracular presence, or the idea that because you wrote a book or two or three that, you know, people really enjoy, that means you have some sort of greater thing to say beyond what's actually in the book. Hmm. So like when I think about Between the World and Me, for me, the most riveting part of that book was, you know, not so much what I had to say, but what Dr. Mabel Jones, Prince Jones's mother, had to say, you know?
Hmm. So let me go back to that, back to why you wrote Between the World and Me. You dedicated your National Book Award and the book to a young man named Prince Jones, whom you knew at Howard University.
Yeah.
Would you just say what happened to him and why it imprinted itself on you so strongly?
Well, Prince was killed by a Prince George's County police officer undercover. And that officer followed my friend, Prince, from Prince George's County through the District of Columbia into Virginia, where he shot him, you know, a short distance away from the home of the mother of his child and you know, where he was going to see his young child. And it imprinted on me because I watched the dialogue about it in the days afterwards, where they speculated, was he a drug dealer? Was he this? Was he that? And Prince was like a, you know, a born again Christian. He was the exact opposite of everything. You know, like this model of who you want, you know, your son to be, you know, publicly, you know, presenting, that I think Black parents often fashion. He was like the walking example of it. You know, he was well-spoken. Yes, sir. No, sir. You know, it's kind of Southern, you know, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am thing. He would have very gentlemanly. I mean, at Howard, he pledged Gentleman of Drew, and like he got killed by a police officer. I mean, it was just the most. And I spent 15 years weighing how that happened and like why the dialogue around him was so different than the person that I knew. And that was the seed of Between the World and Me all those years before.
Why do you think Between the World and Me had the impact that it did? Do you have a sense 10 years later of what it captured in the moment that captured the public attention?
I think there are things that are in your control and things that are not in your control. The thing that was in my control, I should say our control, because I'm about to talk about my wonderful editor, Chris Jackson, was to, like, we had this test, and the test was, could a 14-year-old kid who liked reading read the book? And then the thing that is outside of your control, and that is just where the country is or where the audience is at that particular moment. The Mother Emanuel massacre had happened that summer. Mm-hmm. And actually, the book was not supposed to come out until, I think, end of September, August. And they moved it up after the massacre, because I think people were just searching, you know, for answers as to, like, how this, you know, had happened. Mm.
So let me now quote from your latest book, The Message, which has also caused quite a stir. It may seem strange that a fight that began in the streets has now moved to the library, that a counter-revolution in defense of brutal policing has now transformed itself into a war over scholarship and art. But in the months after George Floyd's murder, books by Black authors on race and racism shot to the top of the bestseller list and most borrowed lists. Black bookstores saw their sales skyrocket. The cause for the spike was, in the main, people who had been exposed to the image of George Floyd being murdered, who suddenly began to suspect that they had not been taught the entire truth about justice, history, policing, racism, and any number of other related subjects. You know, here your book was so celebrated 10 years ago, and then 10 years later, people are trying to ban it or at least make it harder to access. And I just wonder what you make of that.
Probably go hand in hand. I mean, one of the things that, and I went and researched this when I was working on The Message. It's like, you know, Toni Morrison faced bans for like the vast majority of her literary career. Certainly, you know, the greatest novelist of the latter half of the 20th, early 21st century, you know, people put her, you know, in that sort of ranks. And yet she consistently faced bans in a way that I would point out, other writers who might contend for that same title did not. Not in the same degree that she did.
So what kind of conversations are you having, or do you have a sense of what kinds of conversations you're going to have now? Or the lack of conversation a statement in itself?
About Between the World and Me?
Yeah, about Between the World and Me.
You know, it's hard to talk about it. I mean, even now, like, it's weird to talk about the book, because it's like, I feel like, again, you know, I talk about this in The Message about how these, you know, these books are like kids, and they go on and they have their lives. It's like, I really, really believe that once you publish the book, it really doesn't belong to you anymore. It's not yours, you know?
Ta-Nehisi Coates is the author of Between the World and Me, which is celebrating a decade in print, and it's available in paperback now. Ta-Nehisi Coates, thanks so much for talking to us once again.
Thank you, Michelle.
That's all for Dialogue. Our team includes Kennedy Vincent, Ariel Ravney, and me, Patricia Bradford. The theme was composed by Lamont Holden. Dialogue and Illinois Soul are part of Illinois Public Media, which is a service of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. We'll have a dialogue with you again next week.